When you're ready, Mr. Fazola. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jonathan Fazola on behalf of the estate of Naji Ali Baker. I'm honored to be here today, so your honors are aware, with Ronald Baker, Naji's father, and he wanted to make sure I extended to you his gratitude for hearing this case and giving us oral argument so his family through me could be heard, so we appreciate that. Wake Forest knew and was on notice that fights, brawls, and escalating violence were regular features of late-night barn events, dating back to when the barn opened in 2011. Despite that well-documented and lengthy history of violence, in late 2014, Wake Forest slashed on-site security for barn events to a single police officer stationed outside the barn. Wake Forest was repeatedly warned and knew that the one-officer plan was unsafe and irresponsible. Wake Forest hired hands-off security, wanted its own hands-on security for when fights broke out. Student hosts repeatedly begged Wake Forest to let them hire their own or additional hands-on security, such as bouncers for barn events, specifically to keep fights from escalating. Wake Forest's own police chief advanced the recommendation to bring back Winston-Salem.
The fact that this was outside the barn and involved a shooting, and there had been no shootings on campus in the modern era, what does that do to your foreseeability argument?
Well, and thank you for the question, Your Honor, or I guess two questions. The fact that it was outside the barn it has no difference in terms of foreseeability, because those prior events that had broken out and escalated in various down the roadway and into the parking lots, and Wake Forest knew and understood that that was the environment, the specific corner of campus where the risks of altercations at the barn would be located. We know that based on their own diagrams, based on their prior reports, and based on the fact that Officer Bottoms on the night in question, when he came out of the barn with no idea what was going on inside, but had zeroed in on one individual who he decided he needed to make sure to de-escalate the situation and have him followed down the road. When he radioed for backup, he didn't ask them to come to the barn. He asked them to report to Lot W, where he knew and understood that's where the attendees of the barn event were told and directed to park. As to no prior shooting, the case law and the rule in North Carolina is clear through Foster that through the exercise of reasonable care, Wake Forest only needed to have foreseen that some injury would result from an act or admission, or that a consequence of a generally injurious nature might have been expected. That's precisely what the prior events, but also the direct warnings that Wake Forest received before the event on January 19th, 20th, 2018, gave Wake Forest actual, direct, and construct knowledge of. That's why the rule used by the district court, which was basically the rule advanced in the dissent of Foster, of a high degree of recent similar criminality, is just not the law in North Carolina.
Mr. Basler, you, in response to Judge Thacker's question, and understand you said the scope of concern, if you will, based on past events would be beyond, I think you're dealing with to include the parking lot. But is that scope the same scope you said that if they had the, as you say, appropriate number of police officers, would it have how far would that have extended? A mile from it, or what? The parking lot? What would be the terminus of what you say? Because as you know, we're going to get down to proximate cause and
of course
beyond for that kind of thing. How large is that area that policing would have included? That you say the reasonable policing would have included.
Well, and it's a great question, Your Honor, and I don't think we specifically called this out in our brief, but if the record shows that the roadway that we talk about from the barn, the single roadway that was effectively put there just to get to and from the barn, was about 300, 400 feet long, no more, no less. So not a large roadway we're talking about. Parking lots there were two parking lots, LIUNW, just off that roadway, and then from there there were gatehouses, which per its policy and practice, Wake Forest had IDs or had attendees come into barn events, check their IDs. So that's the specific area of the campus in which the risks of fights escalating from barn events and occurring and breaking out was foreseeable to occur. That was the general environment where they had occurred in the past. And that was the general environment when fights broke out, when police officers were at the barn, they'd radio for backup to Lot W, to the roadway, because they knew and understood as the crowd is moving away from the barn, and if there had been violent episodes, that's where they could continue to erupt and spread.
The reasonable foreseeability of things escalating, fights escalating to the point of a shooting on the roadway outside the barn?
The reason for foreseeability is they knew that there'd be fights that could escalate. Fights can escalate in a variety of ways. They had escalated at previous events for someone to being beaten unconscious to the extent that he couldn't talk,
right,
had to be transferred.
So and that incident when someone was unfortunately beaten unconscious, that was in the pre-DOS plan era, right?
Sure, if we're going to draw that line,
was
correct.
At a time when the barn was, in the view, I think, of appellant, more heavily policed, right?
That was, Your Honor. It was also at a time where there were some overcrowding and capacity issues. But the nature of the risk of fights escalating and people, I mean, the individual that was beaten unconscious, it happened right near the exact, almost the precise spot where Najee was shot. He was followed down by Palmer and Piccolo.
At a time when it was heavily policed in the pre-DOS era, correct?
Correct. And even that heavy police force, because of the nature of the brawl at that particular event, you know, Chief Burke had warned when he went and consulted, when fights break out, each fight deserves an officer's attention, and the less officers on site, the less officers there to dedicate that attention to those fights to address them. And once an officer's attention is distracted by one fight, you have a less on-hand security to address others that may break out. I mean, it's precisely as the sequence of events played out on January 20th, 2018, what happened with Officer Bottoms. He went in, didn't know the identity of the combatants, got distracted by a male in a black tank top, used his reasonable police judgment to say, this young man looks kind of heated and out of control, and I need to tell him to chill. He told him to chill, and he testified that he did that to prevent things from escalating. He understood the importance of that, and he also understood the importance of following and having a police officer follow that young man down the road. Fortunately, he hadn't zeroed in because he didn't know on the individuals that presented the most heightened risk of harm that night, Jakir Austin and Malik Smith, because he didn't know they were the initial combatants. He didn't know that Malik Smith, for example, had no right to be in the barn in the first place. And he didn't know that Mr. Willie, a WSU employee and student who was standing outside the barn, heard a group in which one individual said, go get your gun, go get your gun, pull it out, go get it. Testimony from police officers that we deposed from Wake Forest clarified that if they had heard that, it would have immediately signaled to them a potential immediate threat to public safety, would have required an immediate police response, would have required them to call backup, search for the individual who might be going to get his gun, maybe detain him, question him, and make sure he wasn't a risk. That didn't happen. And if Your Honors, it's kind of a dance, but if you look between Officer Bottom's video camera and the which is, I think, DMJ-4, in the video of the first Jakir, then Malik, then Najee, then the individual with the tank top, and then Officer Bottoms leaving the barn, there's a reasonable basis to infer that Mr. Willie may have seen the extra scuffle and then heard, go get your gun, go get your gun, approximately 5 minutes before a gunshot rings out. He sat with that information with his hands in his pocket because he was untrained and he was unprepared to fulfill his responsibility, which Wake Forest had given him, which was to identify risks, this is his testimony, and report them up. Armed with the knowledge for 4 or 5 minutes that someone, after a fight inside the barn, escalation outside the barn, someone said, go get your gun, pull it out, go get it, sat there with his hands in his pockets, didn't convey that information to police. So when Officer Feltz goes down the road, her police lights are off. There's absolutely no urgency. And if you watch Officer Bottom's body cam, He ends up walking down the road after the gunshot is fired.
On the issue of causation, how are we to square the fact that on the record here and all the incidents you cite to, more incidents occurred at the barn before the DOS plan was implemented than after?
In terms of causation, we would say after the DOS plan, Wake Forest was on notice that the features of that plan presented a specific, unique risk that when fights broke out, there'd be less on-hand security to address it, and that meant when they did break out, they could escalate more dangerously than they even had in the past. An important piece of that.
So, Council, I want you to finish Judge Thacker's question, but I just want to make sure I understand it. You're saying that even though their experience with the new plan results in less incidents or fewer incidents and incidents of less severity, that shouldn't affect their foreseeability?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we wouldn't necessarily concede that it resulted in less incidents. Again, we think there's a material dispute of fact on that issue. What we would say is, you know, there's a discussion of us making artificial line drawing. In her declaration, Chief Lawson says, after the university started implementing Chief Burkhead's recommendations, things didn't get better, right? But if you look at the data on that, there were only fights and altercations at about 11% of events. Now, there was a short time period, sure, but that's because Wake Forest quickly abandoned that plan and moved to its one-officer plan. But the reason that's important is there's a reasonable inference to be drawn that the improvements that were seen at the barn were the result of Burkhead's recommendations, which were introduced, and then perhaps a relaxation of the student ID policy at the door, which may have reduced the jam at the door and may have reduced some of the pushing and shoving. But what it did is it let more as...
Did the person that was convicted of the shooting actually have a valid student identification?
You know, he testified that he did, that he wasn't an active student at the time, but that his ID was not... had not been revoked, so he said he was carrying it.
So if somebody looked at it at the door, it would have appeared valid at least, even assuming it should have been revoked.
Assuming, potentially, but his compatriots...
That wouldn't have changed anything.
Well, it would have, because his...
So at least with respect to this, the shooter and his ID.
With respect to Ja'Kir Austin, that's correct, Your Honor, absolutely. But his compatriots were not college students. They didn't have college IDs. And remember, the initial big old brawl, as Ja'Kir Austin described it, didn't start between him and Najee. It involved Malik Smith, who should have never been there, didn't have an ID, and wasn't a college student, had no business being in there. And so to get back to my point about the ID, Wake Forest was on notice. Its officers testified that when non-students came, it increased the risk of criminality. And, you know, Winston-Salem Police Chief, Assistant Police Chief Miles, I think she said when non-students come, they bring trouble. And so effectively, the new plan said we're going to throw open the barn doors to increase criminality. We're going to go 50-50 on that. And then when there's interior fights breaking out, we're going to leave it to students who themselves, the student hosts, are telling us, we need bouncers like a bounce club or like a dance club. We don't feel safe diffusing these fights. And they also, there's evidence that they were disinclined to go get the single officer outside the barn because they didn't want the police coming in, which further compounded the dangerousness of the one officer plan. I see that I'm over my time. And
I want to ask you a question before you go. It's not going to eat away from your rebuttal time.
It's fine.
But I want you to respond before your colleagues on the other side address the court. Getting back to foreseeability, take you back a little back to law school, first year law school, and for your memory should be a lot better first year than mine is, because it's a whole lot more years ago for me. But you know, I think wagon bound type thing where I think it was one or two where the danger, the foreseeability was that a fire might occur. But there was actually remember the case was actually a freak way that it happened. And basically it doesn't matter that the fire occurred. The fire didn't have to occur the way it happened. You couldn't. It's not foreseeable necessarily foreseeability that how it happened, but that it might be a fire. So you don't have firearms, as you said to the court in terms of past. My question is this: so then, it seems to me you'd have to have some kind of level of severe type injury, or at least that would be important to the case. Do you have any evidence that someone was hospitalized, severely injured in any of these brawls? Because a brawl goes from, none of which are correct, mind you, but pushing, shoving, yeah, you get out of my face, and that's a brawl.
Right.
Right? But is there any evidence of injuries, hospitalizations, or someone unconscious, or whatever, in this record?
There is. There's the individual who's beaten unconscious, could only moan, was taken to the hospital. There's
in
the individual.
2012.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah, prior to.
Yeah, and then there's the incident of the young woman being trampled by the crowd, and when she's being transported by Wake Forest Police Department, saying, I don't feel safe here at these barn events with all these non-students. And while she's at the hospital, she overhears another barn attendee who had a gash on his head and was hospitalized, saying he had a gun pulled on him at the barn.
Okay, and the unconscious incident was in 2012 before the DOS plan. When was the young lady trampled? When was that?
That was also prior,
the DOS plan.
That's right. November 13?
Correct.
Okay. Right.
But again, those revealed the risks of fights breaking out and escalating outside of the barn. She was trampled outside of the barn, and the purported gun that was pulled, I believe, was either as the crowd was moving out of the barn or in the grassway of the barn. And after the DOS plan, we saw incidents again and again that showed when fights broke out, they'd escalate. ERMs got punched in the face, pushed in the door, et cetera.
But are there any after the DOS plan in answer to Chief Judge Gregory's question where hospitalizations were required?
Not in the record, no, Your Honor.
Well, other than, okay.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mr. King. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert King. I'm with Brooks Pierce Law Firm in Greensboro, North Carolina. I represent the defendant appellee in this matter. Wake Forest University. I'm joined at counsel table by the Deputy General Counsel of Wake Forest, Ms. Dina Marty. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. If it's agreeable to the court and time permitting, I'd like to address four topics and would like to give the court a quick overview of what those are. First, it occurred to me as I was preparing for this hearing that we really did a poor job in our briefing in describing to the court what is meant by reasonably foreseeable in this context. And as I will explain to the court, what that means is that this type of crime or something similar to that was likely.
If it's not in your brief, you can't argue it. So.
Well, I'll move around some, Your Honor.
I'm not trying to stop you, but that's the rules. You can't didn't brief it, but go ahead.
I understand, Your Honor, and here's my point on that. Everybody agrees that the standard is that the crime or something similar to that is likely, and what we really did not expand on is what likely means in this context. Second, I'd like to talk about why the plaintiff's basic argument is wrong. Plaintiff's basic argument is that fistfights in 2012, 2013, and early 2014 made a fatal ambush shooting outside the barn likely or highly probable to happen years later. Third, I'd like to address the two alternate theories that the plaintiff has come up late in the case to try to avoid the problems that they have with foreseeability. I will also add that of the five things that the plaintiff was required to show evidence of at summary judgment, the existence of a duty, existence of a duty, contours of the duty, breach of the duty, proximate and actual causation, and damages, they showed one, damages. We have been asking from the beginning of the case, what was it that you say we were supposed to do that would have prevented this shooting? Standing here on March 10th, I still have no idea what the answer is because plaintiff failed to come forward with any evidence on that. So plaintiff's two alternate theories are voluntary undertaking, sometimes they call it negligent undertaking, never been recognized in North Carolina. That theory, under a different label, has already been rejected by the North Carolina Court of Appeals. That theory with that label has been rejected by this court in the Durden case. And then what I jumped ahead to, the fact that plaintiff, in fact, failed to present any evidence at summary judgment of what the duty was, how the duty was breached, or what it was that Wake Forest supposedly could have done to have made a difference. So what do we mean by reasonable foreseeability? Plaintiff themselves quote the correct rule, quoting from Murrow v. Daniels on page 24, in fact, of plaintiff's brief. A landowner owes a duty to exercise reasonable ordinary care to protect his patrons from intentional injuries by third parties when the owner has reason to know that such are likely to occur. Not that the injuries might occur, because as the North Carolina courts have said, in some respect, all crimes are foreseeable. I could walk out of here and be shot in front of this building. That's not the standard. The standard is very difficult in North Carolina. Likely means, if you pull out a dictionary, and here I pulled up Merriam-Webster, having a high probability of occurring or being true or very probable. So in order to get to a jury, the plaintiff must present evidence that the crime in question, the ambush shooting of Mr. Baker, was something that was likely to occur or highly probable to occur based on the fact that there had been fistfights that mainly had occurred several years before.
So, counsel, on that point, assume for the sake of discussion that you have a strong argument about the events and the years leading up. What about the day of the incident, the day of this accident, when there's comments that a Wake Forest security official heard that, you know, go get the gun. I don't have the exact language, but I can foresee issues with that related to breach of duty or causation. But how does that not at least create some foreseeability on the day of the event?
Thank you, Your Honor. Great question. That was in my outline, and I'll go ahead and address that. First of all, the evidence in the record as to the time difference between when this student employee heard this and when he heard the gunshots was 2 to 3 minutes. That is a late-blooming theory. It is not in the complaint.
Well, that might get to whether if they did something, they breached the duty, and it might get to causation, but stick for the moment with foreseeability when a Wake Forest security official apparently hears, go get a gun, and decides it's not really a real threat.
Okay, and I will do that, Your Honor. First of all, as I was mentioning, it's a late-blooming theory. It's not in the complaint. It's not mentioned at all by their expert because their expert didn't say anything about it. Our experts didn't say anything about it. We start dealing with this issue in summary judgment after the close of discovery. But let's be clear about what was said because that theory makes absolutely no sense. What this person overheard was not, I've got a gun, I'm going to go get a gun, or he's got a gun. It's one person walking away from a building yelling at some guy down the road, go get your gun. Well, by definition, nobody had a gun. So what was it that somebody was supposed to do? Was a police officer supposed to run and grab this person and say, why did you yell that? Well, I thought this guy might have a gun. Go grab that other person. Do you have a gun? By definition, he didn't have a gun. So we're talking about this theory that was never raised before summary judgment. There's no evidence in the record, no suggestion by plaintiff as to what should have happened. And I think that goes both to the foreseeability and to the issue of breach of duty. I want to go back, if I could, for a second to the foreseeability issue because it is important to consider, I think, how tough the North Carolina law is on this. I have read every case in this topic or in this area. These cases go back to 1934, Ward versus Southern Railway, and I'd like to talk about that case for a second. In 88 years of jurisprudence, North Carolina appellate courts 5 times have ever said that a plaintiff presented evidence of foreseeability and proximate causation sufficient to get to a jury. That was a shopping mall with a long history of similar violent crimes, a bus station with a long history of violent crimes, and three motels in high crime areas with long histories of crimes. In our situation, Wake Forest has got to be one of the safest places in North Carolina. In 63 years, we'd never had a homicide. We'd never had anybody use a firearm for anything. We had never had a crime anywhere remotely near this. The record, counsel wants to speculate about the idea that maybe there's a factual dispute about whether or not things improved over time or not. They did improve over time, and there is nothing but speculation on the other side that it did not improve over time.
Counsel, is that our lens that Wake Forest as a whole, or should, I think your colleague would say, maybe generally that's true, but the lens should be at this barn rather than the school as a whole. So I'm not saying who's right, who's wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what they would say to that. What's your response to that?
Well, I would start with saying that the plaintiff gets to frame the issue in the complaint. And if you read the complaint, this is a complaint about campus security. It is not a complaint just about the barn. Let's say it's just about the barn. Never been a homicide at the barn, never been a fatal shooting at the barn. And here's the thing that really, this whole thing about we've had these fights and things might escalate, I think that actually hurts plaintiff's case. And here's why. The argument is fist fights make it foreseeable that someone's going to pull out a gun in the heat of passion and shoot somebody. Well, first of all, that's not what plaintiff says happened. What plaintiff says happened is that Najee Baker was calmly strolling to his car when he was ambushed. So this whole idea that there was a fist fight and somebody became enraged and pulled out a gun is not, in fact, what plaintiff themselves says happened. Second, the fact that there have been fights on campus and none of them ever resulted in this type of injury kind of proves our point. Look, Wake Forest has had a campus here for 63 years, and where there are colleges, there are college parties, and where there are college parties, there are overheated young men. And where there are overheated young men, there are fistfights. We've got 63 years of college people doing the things that I did and other college people do, and nobody ever pulled out a gun, nobody ever had a gun, nobody ever got murdered. You talk about data points. That's 63 years of that. And let me mention this. I've been struggling with this idea of how to put the incredibly unprecedented nature of this into arithmetic terms or mathematical terms. And I came up with this idea of the visitor day, sort of like a work day. One person on the campus, one day is one visitor day. If you take the number of days that this campus has existed prior to the shooting of Mr. Baker, multiply it just by the number of students, faculty, and staff, forget people coming to parties, forget visitors, forget vendors, you have 500 million visitor days before this shooting where nothing remotely similar to this happened. If I roll the dice 500 million times and it comes up snake eyes every time, it is not foreseeable that anything else is going to happen. So this idea that fistfights turn into shootings is rebutted by the actual facts of this case. I want to mention two cases. I mentioned there are only five cases in the history of North Carolina jurisprudence, and they're all terrible cases. I mean, the lesson there is don't go to motel parking lots at 2 o'clock in the morning, because that's what most of these cases are about. Let me talk about two cases where the court said there is not foreseeability, that are pretty remarkable cases to me. And the first one is the granddaddy of them all, or the grandmother of them all, Ward versus Southern Railway. 1934, for 30 years, people had been climbing on coal cars and throwing chunks of coal over the side, which was a crime. They were stealing coal. The railway knew it for 30 years. Somebody throws a piece of coal off, and this particular time, it hits a brakeman on the head and kills him. The brakeman's family sues the railway, and the Supreme Court said, yes, this criminal activity had been going on for 30 years, this exact activity. Yes, the railway knew it was going on for 30 years. No, it was not foreseeable, because nobody had ever been hurt. The other one I'll mention to you is Purvis versus Bryson Jewelers, which happened in my hometown. Purvis versus Bryson Jewelers was a situation in which somebody was injured during armed robbery at a jewelry store. There had been...
In that case, do you think it may have been a difference that there was trespassers who were the tortfeasor's third party, as opposed to invited guests to the barn and a regular type event that the school quasi-sponsored by allowing it?
No, that's a great question, Your Honor. The law in North Carolina prior to 1998 was that there were different standards for trespassers, but that was if the trespasser was the plaintiff. It was the duty owed to the person. So the standard of care... In 1934.
You tell me that being responsible for a third party's acts, the fact that they're trespassers would not factor into that analysis?
Not based on any of the cases that I've read, Your Honor. Because the issue is not whether these people were trespassers. The issue was whether or not the railway knew that this activity was going on, that this criminal activity was going on. And what the Supreme Court said was, yeah, it went on for 30 years. Yeah, the railway knew what was going on. Yeah, the exact same thing happened that day that had happened for 30 years, but it was not foreseeable that someone was going to get hurt because this time somebody got hit on the head and it had never happened before. The Purvis case that I would mention to the court, jewelry store robbery. In the vicinity of the jewelry store, there had been 937 crimes and 24 armed robberies in the prior 3 years. Now, that sounds like a foreseeability situation, and the Court of Appeals said that was not foreseeable because none of those happened at a jewelry store. That's the standard in North Carolina, and that's why we've got five cases in 88 years, and all of them are egregious situations. The Wake Forest situation could not be any more different than the five cases where the court has found foreseeability. I covered that. Oh, here's the other thing I would mention on foreseeability. We have to keep in mind how many security professionals had looked at the barn and considered security at the barn prior to the tragic shooting of Mr. Baker. Wake Forest Police had looked at it. Winston-Salem Police had looked at it. The Rhino security folks had looked at it. The Dean of Students Office had looked at it. Chief Burkhead had looked at it. You had all these security professionals that came in. They thought about it. They looked about at it. They wrote about it. Not a single person ever said, I'm afraid there's going to be a shooting. Not a single person ever said, if we don't do this X, Y, or Z, I'm afraid there's going to be a homicide. If it was foreseeable that activities at the barn were going to result in a homicide or a shooting, let alone an ambush shooting, why did every single security professional miss that fact? I think I've addressed one of the two alternate theories. Plaintiff has put a lot of stock in this idea of a voluntary undertaking, although sometimes they call it a negligent undertaking. As I mentioned previously, that has never been recognized by a North Carolina court, but in fact, it has been rejected by the North Carolina Court of Appeals, applying a different label. In the case of Urbano versus Days Inn, the plaintiff was attacked in a motel parking lot, as most of these cases are. One of the plaintiff's arguments was, and this will sound familiar to the court, that the motel said to the public, we are providing security and our property is safe. That is exactly what the plaintiff is trying to argue here. Now, in the Urbano case, the label that the plaintiff put on it was implied warranty. It's the same thing that's being argued here, voluntary undertaking. And the North Carolina Court of Appeals said no, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to get around the foreseeability argument. What you're trying to do is completely rewrite North Carolina law by making people guarantors. And this is exactly what they said. Under our decisional law, an innkeeper or other occupier of property is not the insurer of the personal safety of the business invitees, period. This exact argument has already been rejected under North Carolina law. It could not be a more transparent effort to avoid the issue of foreseeability. I'll also mention that the Fourth Circuit, applying North Carolina law, has rejected voluntary undertaking in a wrongful death. I'm not a wrongful death. It was an assault case in the matter of Durden versus United States as well. I'd like to briefly touch on
the new arguments that you've regaled us in North Carolina law some 80-some years. Would it be different if this happened in a dorm? Because you open the door by your extolling the history of the university in general, so you open it up. Would this be different if it happened in a dorm?
I don't see how, if everything else was the same, Your Honor, I think the answer is no. Because the issue is, what have we seen in the past? And none of the courts quite put it this way, but what all these cases boil down to is that when you hear about the crime, if your reaction is, yeah, I saw that coming, then it's foreseeable. 63 years, half a billion visitor days without something like this happen, I don't know how you can say that it was foreseeable that this was going to happen. Last thing that I would mention, because this court can obviously affirm on a summary judgment record on other grounds, plaintiff completely failed to provide any evidence at summary judgment as to what the standard of care was. They've never said, because here's what we expected when this lawsuit got filed. I thought they would bring in former chief of police from Tech State University who would say, I've done a risk assessment of this property, and Wake Forest failed because they should have done A, B, and C, and if they had done A, B, and C, this shooting would not have happened. And of those things, plaintiff did none of them. Plaintiff did not provide an expert who had any knowledge about how campus security works. He said that how other colleges handle these situations was irrelevant. He didn't say what the standard of care was, and there's no indication of causation in this matter. What in the world was it that we were supposed to do? And the answer that we get in the briefing is, well, if you'd had more police officers, maybe one of the police officers would have been in the right place at the right time. I mean, that's just rank speculation of counsel. That is not evidence before the court. So if the court were to find foreseeability in this situation, there's no evidence of standard of care, there's no breach of the standard of care, there's no evidence of causation. I will close by saying, if I can find the right place in my notes, if this court were to reverse and find that Wake Forest could be liable in this situation, despite the fact that in 63 years nothing remotely similar has happened, despite the fact that this facility was repeatedly analyzed by security professionals, and not a single one of them said, I'm concerned there's going to be a shooting, I'm concerned there's going to be a homicide. The court will be massively rewriting North Carolina law, and what will be happening is that property owners will become guarantors of the safety of the people that come on their property, and that's something that the North Carolina Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals have been saying since 1934 is not the law. What happened to the Baker family is awful, and I hate to get up here and make an impassioned argument when I've got a grieving family across the aisle. It is awful what happened to them, but this is not the university's fault. I appreciate the court's time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. So, Vizzola, you have some time.
It's categorically untrue that this case is about campus security writ large. Your honors have our complaint. We don't make it about campus security writ large. That's evidenced by the fact that when Wake Forest tries to attempt our cite our complaint in their brief to make it a case about campus security writ large, they inaccurately quote and leave out key passages. The case has always been about. Yes, sir.
You can argue the case the way you want. You're up on rebuttal, but it might be helpful, at least to me, for you to answer this question to the breach. What standard of care and what's the evidence at this stage of breach of that standard?
And I really appreciate that question. You know, it's first incorrect that our expert, Dr. Kirkham, didn't provide a standard of care. Mr. King, during his deposition, didn't ask him about the central opinions in his case. The reason Dr. Kirkham opined that doing a campus-wide security audit wasn't necessary is because that's not what his opinions were directed at. His standard of care he articulates is having sufficient on-site security to respond, see, and intervene in fights to de-escalate them and to, without force, escort people off the campus. I'm a little shocked to hear Mr. King say he still has no idea what Wake Forest could have done. They could have done what they had done, been doing, what their officers' plans had shown. They could have been done what they did previously,
So you're saying that your expert established, let's say, in your view, that there was a breach of a standard. That would be the standard of staffing. Correct, right? Am I correct?
Correct. Although I will push back that in these cases, there is not a requirement that we establish standard of care through expert testimony. And
no,
I also.
I'm just trying to figure out what you do have. I didn't say that. I'm saying that you is it correct that, forget about standard, your expert established a guidelines for staffing requirements, numbers of police officers, positioning, right? That's what you're saying?
No, he did not establish a guideline because his point was you could use various mixes of security. What was important, though, was to make sure you had in officers or officers inside to monitor risk. He offers an alternative, making sure that if you reduce the number inside the barn of officers because you don't want too many because of student perceptions, make sure they have radio contact with outside officers or other security officials on the ground. That didn't happen here. Again, that would have been a way the inside people responding could radio out and say, we have people coming out that were involved in a fight. One of them's wearing a red hoodie. It's pretty easy to spot. But standard of care was articulated by the officers we deposed themselves by saying, for example, Sergeant Fisher recognizing the importance of having on-site security interior to identify, quickly respond to risks. The Sergeant Gravely testified to that. And Sheriff Burkhead, who offered his recommendations, I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm surprised. What could they have done? Here are his recommendations. Officers inside to monitor potential risks. Enforce ID rule, no exceptions.
I think you've answered my question.
Right.
The next
right.
is on that is having, let's say, assume you did that. What about causation? It's a lot of layers in these kind of cases. What about causation?
There's a number of things that could have prevented this shooting that Wake Forest could and should have done. Again, if they had someone inside to monitor the risk and quickly identify the combatants, they would have been able to detain, or not detain at least.
Did this fight spill into the parking lot?
It spilled.
You know what I mean by spill, right?
Well, it spilled outside of the barn and continued.
Did it spill into the parking lot? You know what I mean? Do we make it clear?
Well, yeah. I would say it spilled in the form of Malik Smith, who, by Keandra Johnson's testimony, ran to his car to get a gun to run back up the road, still operating under the heat of the moment. And if you were to believe Jakir Austin's testimony, he was, quote-unquote, tripping, and he was mad. There's no evidence to suggest a different motive for them to shoot Najee other than a continuation of the ambush that happened in the, or the fight that happened in the barn that escalated outside and that led down foreseeably down the roadway. And I do want to say, because my time is limited, Your Honors, the discussion about foreseeability that Mr. King keeps bringing up is just simply not the rule in North Carolina. You do not have to show a prior homicide to make a homicide foreseeable. And importantly, that's a foreseeability rule for circumstantial evidence. What's that, Your Honor?
You have to show that it's similar in some way. I take it that it doesn't have to be an exact match, but some similarity.
The lines the court draws are the crimes involving actual or threatened physical harm. Those are relevant to circumstantial evidence. And crimes that don't involve that, property crimes, robbing things from cars, that's the lines the courts have drawn. They've never said you need to show substantial similarity. That's the dissent in Foster. And again, that's under the circumstantial evidence test. We have direct knowledge of warnings. Mr. King brought up college parties. I've never been to a college party where I left saying that was a great party, but what could really use is some bouncers to make us safe. We also have evidence that Rhino Security wasn't aware that requests for bouncers were being made, and that those requests by the sorority never made it to the police force. The Chief Lawson, there's no evidence she was aware that the student hosts were saying, we need bouncers to make this event safe.
Could I follow up a little bit on the discussion of the North Carolina cases? I take to some extent at least your point about, criminal activity involving property versus criminal activity involving personal injury or bodily injury.
Right.
But does it matter that in those cases there is criminal activity? And again, I'm not meaning to condone fighting on campus, but is fighting on campus even, as it shouldn't happen, the same if it's is it criminal activity, and does that matter?
I believe it is criminal activity. Most importantly, it involves actual or threatened physical harm to somebody.
Right.
And that's enough to trigger, and again, that's the circumstantial evidence box, foreseeability under Foster. On frequency, I need to make this point if I can. There were 2 to 3 barn events a semester. 4 hours a barn event, okay? Over 6 years. I'm not a mathematician, but if you do the math, that's about 12 hours of barn events each semester, which would be about 12 convenience store days, if we assume a convenience store is open, 12 convenience store days during the life of the barn. If you view the frequency of fights, altercations, both before and after the DOS plan, against a matrix of 12 convenience store days, if that frequency was happening at any convenience store in America, we'd all expect that they reevaluate what they're doing to make sure that their customers, unknowing customers coming onto their property, had sufficient safeguards in place. And with that, I see I'm over my time. I could talk forever, and I appreciate Your Honor's time and patience today. We'd ask.
Well, I took some of your time. I'll give you 2 minutes if you want to, because it was your rebuttal.
Okay, and I really do appreciate that, Your Honor. I want to say quickly, I'm going to go through, the reason they want to make this a campus security case is those are the whack-a-mole cases, right? Random campus rape in a dorm. How are we supposed to know about that? Whack-a-mole, right? Random abduction in the corner of campus not related to an on-campus event with a history of violence at a specific location with a history where you know it's going to be there at a limited time with a crowd of people. Whack-a-mole, right? Even motel parking lots. Who knows when the motel bandits are going to show up at any given time? That's a security whack-a-mole, And so we might, under circumstantial evidence, we want to make sure that there's, sufficient foreseeability there. Here, we have an event in a specific corner of campus, specific time, with specific persons going to be there, with specific knowledge of the known risks, and it's completely different than a campus-wide security case such as the one out of Louisiana, for example, where there's an individual sitting in the dorm and spontaneously out of nowhere stands up and shoots a young woman getting on the elevator. Those are the cases that are trying to make universities insurers of everybody's safety at all times, at all hours. That is often not a fair burden to put on a university. But here, when you have direct knowledge and circumstantial evidence telling you we have barn events at a specific time, late night, and fights can break out and escalate, and you're being warned by your own hands-off security that they think you should have wands and you should have bouncers or bring back WSPD, and you're being warned by your own student host, including a month before the shooting where four fights broke out and didn't stop until it was down the road and a police could intervene, you have a duty to exercise reasonable care to respond appropriately, and you certainly have a duty, we submit, to not to if you've undertaken to do something that you're told is irresponsible and unsafe, to make sure you're exercising reasonable care in that undertaking. And finally, on that point, Castle does not foreclose the negligent undertaking theory against premise liability or owners of premises. Castle involved a private security firm in North Carolina. Is clear undertaken in those contexts is defined by a contract. Security firm had a contract. The contract did not require the security firm to intervene in the stabbing that was taking place. They were just supposed to be there to be a deterrent. So the court said it wouldn't be fair to impose any duty here. They agreed to what their undertaking was, four corners of the contract. The court in that case did say, though, that the provision of the security by the hotel may be relevant to the, by the apartment, to the apartment's liability, but the court didn't need to decide that issue because the apartment wasn't a defendant, at least in that portion of the case. I don't know how much more time your honors are going to give me. I appreciate it.
It's red now.
Okay.
You got two.
I apologize. I would just say as a final word, since you've indulged me, we ask that your honors reverse the district court and remand with instructions to set this matter for trial, and also with an instruction that the district court correct its opinion so that Najee Baker's name isn't confused with the name of his shooter. We thank you, thank you for your time and for hearing our case. Thank you so much.
To counsel all, we appreciate your arguments here today. We would love to come down and greet you in our normal Fourth Circuit tradition, but we can't. But know nonetheless that we appreciate all of you being here and helping us on this case. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.